Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. Woman who brings uncommon intelligence to these matters is a regular here at Secure Freedom Radio, I'm very pleased to say, Diana West, a longtime syndicated columnist, a blogger par excellence, a best-selling author of Death of the Grown-Up and American Betrayal, and one of the most astute observers of particularly things that, well, we may be hearing a lot about, but the dots are not always connected as they should, specifically with respect to the kind of political warfare that is waged inside our own country, at the cultural level, at the, well, the straight old-fashioned partisan level, of course, but also in terms of the narratives that we are being fed and what we therefore think about the world in which we live. Diana, it's good to have you back to help parse some of these against the backdrop of the upcoming meeting between Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin on the margins of the G20 summit in Buenos Aires, Argentina. Welcome back.
Yes, thank you. Yes, this is a very apt moment as we look at this meeting coming up, because everything happening at home vis-a-vis the Russia-Trump investigation seems designed to place President Trump in a very difficult position. And I believe that that's calculated as part of this ongoing political warfare.
Yeah. And to the extent that we've learned in recent days still more about the kind of political warfare that has been waged against him going back to the time of his candidacy, there's apparently, in addition to the notorious Russia dossier that the Clinton campaign fabricated and then inserted into official circles in the Obama administration, another dossier. Can you tell us about it?
Yes. Well, this came out earlier this year that there was a second dossier or chief of opposition research concocted by the notorious Clinton fixers, Sidney Blumenthal and Cody Shearer. They go way back to the early days of the Clinton machine and indeed were involved in any number of dirty tricks, leaks, blackening of reputations, investigations, really dark ops of the underside, the seamy side of politics. And Lee Smith did some very interesting reporting on this because he found out that this was being shopped around early before we even see Christopher Steele come onto the scene. And it looks to me almost as if it's possible that that dossier itself is the granddaddy of the Steele operation. In other words, that this the add-on would be bringing in this British intelligence sheen or polish onto essentially another Clinton operation, another dirty tricks operation. It's a theory of mine. It needs to be tested. We're less and less likely to see this tested, though, as the narrative solidifies. And that's something you were just alluding to in a way. There are certain aspects of this case that have been repeated and almost given to us as catechism, political catechism, which have not been proven. And this is one, that the DNC server was hacked by the Russians. I mean, this is now we're supposed to believe this like a commandment, still not proven. The second point we're supposed to believe as a commandment is that Vladimir Putin was dying to see Donald Trump come to the White House, take power of the government, and begin expanding our defense capabilities and revamping our nuclear arsenal.
As opposed to Hillary Clinton, who had no interest in doing any of that, of course, and with whom he had been doing some very dubious deals.
Yes, and who specifically, as a candidate, told a crowd at a fundraiser that she saw no reason to modernize our nuclear cruise missiles, that she saw no reason to go into that. So this is a ridiculous strategic blunder of Vladimir Putin to decide that Trump would have been his man. But we're supposed to believe that because James Comey told us that. This again comes back to this creation of narrative. So every bit of breaking news that is put on top of that flawed foundation is taking us farther away from any understanding of what's really going on. And then meanwhile, you know, we all focus on the death of Khashoggi, the murder of Khashoggi, and there's no interest in what happened to the murder of Seth Rich, a Democratic National Committee official, voter data expansion official, who was murdered during the campaign season in July of 2016, and whom Julian Assange of WikiLeaks all but confirmed was the source of the leak of these materials that have now, you know, been assigned to the GRU in Moscow. I mean, in terms of a hack. None of this has been proven, and Mueller has no interest in proving it because he's driving a political narrative. And this is sort of where we are in really losing touch with all, you know, hope of getting to the truth of this in any official way.
Yeah. Diana West, part of why I think you have such clarity on these issues is you have spent so much of your professional life trying to really take the facts where they lead, not to some preordained conclusion. And much of that work has involved trying to unravel, as you do so brilliantly in American Betrayal, some of the sort of notions, nostrums, narratives, whatever you want to call them, of the years in which we were assured that communism was not a problem, that we can safely have communists in our government, that we can begin to have relations with the Soviet Union on the basis that they would not interfere with our government and the like, and that, you know, ultimately led us into the morass of people who tried to expose why all of that was wrong, notably Joseph McCarthy, were vilified to a point where today, as you've documented so well, the term McCarthyism is one of the most, you know, pejorative political epithets in our vocabulary.
Yes, well, thank you. Yes, it's an epithet, but it's also a weapon because it's one of those words or one of those magic incantations that prevent people from doing their due diligence, taking the care to understand what subversion is, how it works, and how it's working against us to this day. So it becomes a tremendous weapon used by our enemies and friends alike to essentially blind us, to keep us not just willfully blind, but just blind in every possible way. And, you know, we become victim of authority that just is simply ordaining truth as they see it and not where the facts take us. And that's where it becomes so dangerous and so dispiriting. So this is, you know,
we're ripe for manipulation. We're ripe for essentially submission to these narratives, to these increasingly authoritarian sort of advocates of those nostrums, as I say. And this is really why I think it's so valuable to have our opportunities each week with you to take stock. And I really encourage our listeners to go to dianawest.net for a deeper dive on the kind of research and analysis that Diana West does so brilliantly. It's available through other sources too, but dianawest.net is where you can find it most conveniently, as you can in our conversations with her each week. Diana West, thank you so much. I hope you'll come back to us again next week, as always. And in the meantime, keep up the terrific work you do at dianawest.net. Next up, we will speak with Jonathan Speier about the Middle East and the developments there, ISIS and Iran, that might have very real implications for us. That and more straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back. We're joined once again. It's been the first time in a long time, I'm sorry to say, by Dr. Jonathan Speier. He is the director of the Rubin Center, formerly the Gloria Center at Herzliya in Israel. He's a fellow of the Middle East Forum and the author of several important books: Days of the Fall, A Reporter's Journey in Syria and Iraq Wars, and The Transforming Fire, The Rise of the Israeli Islamist Conflict. He is, among other things, a columnist for the Jerusalem Post, and you can find his writings in all the right places. We're always delighted to have him with us. Jonathan, very welcome back. Good to have you.
Thanks for having me. Good to be here.
Well, there's so much you've been reporting on lately, Jonathan, that I want to really take stock with you about. And some of them are themes that we touch on a fair amount here, but I think you bring a fresh perspective to them. Specifically, I wanted to get your thoughts on what you call the return of ISIS. We are largely under the impression in the United States, I think, that ISIS, the Islamic State, is crushed as a result of the decisive military defeats it suffered in the past year or so at the hands of, well, the Trump administration particularly and its coalition partners. You say not so. What's the evidence of that? And more to the point, what are the implications if you're right?
First of all, of course, people are right in saying that the Islamic State as a quasi-state that did exist in a large swathe of eastern Syria and western Iraq, this entity has largely been destroyed by partners on the ground. Mosul has gone, Raqqa has gone, and so on and so forth. But what we're now seeing is that the Islamic State as an insurgent network, the same network that created that quasi-state, has not been destroyed with the destruction of that state, but rather the core leaders of ISIS did not wait in the rubble of Raqqa or Mosul to be killed by coalition air power or Kurdish bullets, but rather made good their escape prior to the fall of those cities and are now in the process of reorganizing. And the figures which I've heard, that they have made up to $400 million from the money which they taxed, extorted in the course of the years of the Islamic State, around 30,000 fighters, plenty of weaponry. So they are there and they're reforming as a network. And if we look at certain geographical locations, particularly in Iraq, places like the Hamrin Mountains, Hawija, traditional heartlands of Sunni jihadi politics in the past, that's where we can note them emerging. I was just last week in Iraq reporting on some of this stuff. And I went to a place called Karachok Mountain, just north of Mahmur, and we visited a mountainous area there with the Kurdish fighters. And we saw a cave system where 300 ISIS men have installed themselves in very inhospitable cave conditions where they're preparing to rebuild networks, to carry out attacks, to plant IEDs. It's a classic moment in a pre-insurgency situation where the insurgents regroup, go out to remote areas, begin to reorganize to amass resources, and then at a certain stage relaunch their insurgency. And that, I would warn, is the current situation which we're looking at with regard to ISIS.
And obviously, that means that we're at the cusp of a whole new wave of terror and jihadism at their hands, and certainly in Iraq and I assume in Syria as well. We've also seen, Jonathan Speier, as you know so well, the outcroppings of the Islamic State elsewhere, some in Africa, some in other parts of the Middle East, and even, I think, out in the Philippines, if I'm not mistaken. There's this ideology that is very much alive and well, it certainly seems. I call it Sharia supremacism, but unless that's defeated, as well as the outward manifestations of the fighting force, there is not much likelihood that we're going to see an end to the predations of the Islamic State, are we?
I agree with you, and I think that, of course, is a much larger, even generational task, which needs to be undertaken. I can say, from the point of view of somebody who, you know, watches developments here in the Middle East from a pretty close vantage point, that unfortunately we're quite far from getting to that point, at least out here. It is a sad fact that once you take politics to street level and military organization to street level in the Sunni Arab world, the people that win time and time again are political Islam, the various manifestations of political Islam. And that ultimately is what has to change, I would suggest, for real progress to begin to be made.
Yeah. Well, let me ask to sort of spin off of that a question about something else that you've been reporting on. It isn't entirely about Arabs, but the Turks as well. In the contest for influence and leadership of the Sunni world, you have, on the one hand, Mohammed bin Salman and his allies circling around, of course, his own country of Saudi Arabia. On the other, you have the Turks and you have the Qataris. You have the Muslim Brotherhood. You even have the Iranians sort of teaming for rivalry and influence within what I would guess call the Muslim world more than just the Arab. But how do you see, particularly in the aftermath of this Khashoggi affair, Jonathan Speier, this playing out? Are we likely to see the Turks and Qataris and their friends benefiting from it and being able to turn it to advantage in terms of not only maintaining the venomous ideological force of their strain of Sharia supremacism on the one hand, and perhaps, you know, upsetting entirely the promising developments vis-a-vis Israel that we've seen under the influence of Mohammed bin Salman?
The Turks and the Qataris and their many, unfortunately, many allies in parts of the news media have done and are doing their level best to leverage what appears to have been the murder of Jamal Khashoggi in the consulate in Istanbul into political advantage. It's a supremely cynical act, I would say, whatever the terrible and dreadful facts of the murder, and it does appear to be a dreadful act, but it's a supremely cynical act given the fact that, you know, Erdogan himself of Turkey is one of the supreme, you know, harriers and harassers of journalists in the region, the person who, you know, more or less single-handedly destroyed the free media or remnants of the free media in his own country. So there's a supreme cynicism to all this, but they are certainly doing their very best to promote this agenda. Khashoggi certainly didn't deserve the fate that he appears to have suffered. At the same time, he was a man who said, and I quote, political reform and democracy in any Arab country without accepting that political Islam is part of it. That's a quote from the late Jamal Khashoggi. So he was clearly a friend of political Islam. Ultimately, this is about politics and about power like everything else. They're in their best to leverage that. Will they succeed? Look, they've gained points, undoubtedly, you know, as a result of this. Doesn't mean that the game's over. And I would suggest that, you know, such figures as MBS in Saudi Arabia, that it remains a matter of urgency for all those of us who are aware of the nature of the Muslim Brotherhood and that that stream and what it intends for Israel and what it intends for the West. We need to be doing our best to maintain clarity on this.
Yeah, well, I couldn't agree more with that, Jonathan Speier. Let me turn quickly in closing to this country I mentioned at the tail end of that last question, Iran. Could you just give us at the 30,000-foot level an appreciation of what you think Iran's game is at the moment in the Middle East? They're clearly suffering from sanctions. The president, I think, has upset a lot of their plans with his efforts to repudiate the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action and so on. But what is Iran doing at the moment on the ground, as you see it, and again, its implications?
Yes, well, the Iranians have, I would say, a very well-worked-out methodology and practice of revolutionary and irregular and political warfare, which they are currently applying in a whole number of arenas in the Middle East region. They're applying in Yemen, they're applying it in Iraq, they're applying in Syria, they're applying it in Lebanon. And in most of those spaces, they have moved forward and advanced very substantially over the course of the regional chaos of the last 7 or 8 years. So right now, they have clients, powerful political / military proxies active in all those spaces. And what they're doing, their level best to continue to leverage the presence of those proxies towards greater political power and influence with the Iranians themselves. And specifically, what the goals of that are, the Iranians wish to secure, at the very least, a corridor of power, if not total power in the entire space between the Iraq-Iran border and Mediterranean Sea, in the border with Israel, taking in 3 nominally existent Arab countries, Iraq, Syria, and Lebanon, with it, which the Iranians treat as a single space, essentially, and operate on that, on that basis. And with regard to Yemen, they seek, of course, to continue to support the Houthi Ansar Allah uprising there with a specific goal, which they would like to achieve, although they probably won't achieve it now, of reaching the Bab al-Mandeb Strait in the southern part of the country, which would enable them then to choke maritime traffic coming from the Gulf up towards the Suez Canal. That was a strategic goal there. So they're doing, they have very geostrategic goals in the region intended to increase the power of Islamic Republic of Iran, a very clear and visible praxis as to how they wish to go about doing that. With minimal cost, I would put to Iranian life itself. They're very keen on fighting to the last Arab, as some cynical or more cynical observers look at it. The goals are clear. The method is clear. Iran has been moving forward. There are now some encouraging signs that the United States, certainly, and its allies in the region are beginning to take note of that and beginning to organize a coherent strategy to contain the Iranians and then to roll them back.
Yeah, but the hour is late. I think we have to acknowledge that, and there's a lot on the line. Jonathan Spire, there is much more to talk about on all of these subjects. I hope you'll come back to us again in the very near future. In the meantime, I appreciate what you do at the Rubin Center, as well as the Middle East Forum. And congratulations again on your coverage of these issues, notably in Days of the Fall, A Reporter's Journey in the Syrian and Iraq Wars. Come back to us again soon. We'll talk next with Tony Badran. We'll get into some of these same issues with him from a different American perspective right after this.
More with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. It is a pleasure to say we are joined by Tony Badran, a research fellow at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. He is also a columnist and the Levant analyst for Tablet Magazine, an important online resource. You can find his writings in numerous places, the Los Angeles Times, the Washington Post, Foreign Affairs, and most recently with Michael Duran, an important piece that we want to talk with him about today in the New York Times. Tony, it's good to have you back. Welcome. So glad to have you with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Listen, what is particularly valuable about you and Jonathan Spire, our previous guest, is I think your ability to help us make some sense of a lot of information that is seemingly pretty dynamic and certainly confusing. But I want to have this conversation with you, particularly against the backdrop of legislation that is now moving through the Senate of the United States at the instigation of Bernie Sanders that is designed to essentially halt U.S. support for the Saudi-led operations in Yemen. And you have some really important insights, Tony, about how what's playing out in Yemen against the backdrop of this Khashoggi affair and the other, you know, interlacing competitions with the Turks, with the Iranians, with the Qataris. This really is sort of a piece with what's happening and has happened in your native homeland of Lebanon. Talk us through this.
Sure. So what has happened since the affair of the murder of the Saudi national, Jamal Khashoggi, is that there's been a campaign in the United States spearheaded by former Obama administration officials who are pushing on the back of the murder what their agenda was when they were in power, which is a realignment of U.S. interests away from traditional U.S. allies like Israel and Saudi Arabia and more in line with Iran. So the way to achieve that is to downgrade, or what the words they use is recalibrate, the U.S. relationship with Saudi Arabia. And what they found as the most useful angle to achieve this is the war in Yemen. Now, what's happening in the war in Yemen is that in 2015, it started actually in late 2014, but it came to a head in 2015. An Iran-backed group, which is known as the Houthis or Ansar Allah, which has had a long-standing relationship with Iran and Hezbollah, and has been the recipient of Iranian arms years before the war in Yemen broke, toppled the government of Yemen and moved to seize large parts of the country, including very important strategic points on the Red Sea. including the Bab el-Mand, sort of overlooking the Bab el-Mandeb Straits, which is an important choke point for the water, for the for oil shipments, and the port of Hudaydah, which is on the Red Sea, which is the largest port in Yemen. So Iranian missiles and other types of weaponry, including drone boats and mines and all kinds of things, right on top of this strategic waterway and right on the border of a critical U.S. ally, in a situation that could be analogous, really, to what we have seen, what the Iranians have done on the northern border of Israel, and to, in fact, on the southern border of Israel as well. So they've established a missile base that's overlooking U.S. allies. So no sane government on earth is going to accept this kind of reality on their borders. And it's not because of the Red Sea situation and its importance to the global economy. This goes beyond a mere Saudi national security issue to a global economic interest and a direct interest to the United States to make sure that these guys are defeated and that Iran does not get to establish that kind of presence in Yemen.
Yeah. And just to put a fine point on it, were they to succeed and were the United States Senate and in due course the Congress to pursue this policy of essentially entrenching the Iranian Houthi-backed forces in a position to constrict both the choke point of the Strait of Hormuz, of course, in the Persian Gulf, as well as the Bab el-Mandeb, this could really create incredibly dangerous restrictions on the flow of energy to the rest of the world. So there's, as you say, there's huge stakes here. And how far advanced would you say are the Iranians towards achieving this goal? They seem to be back on their heels until the Khashoggi affair. Is the effect of this influence operation, as you see it, Tony Badran, that they're now perhaps going to be able to snatch victory from the jaws of defeat?
Well, that's really what's at stake. Now, look, to be sure, the war has not necessarily been prosecuted in the most effective way, which is why the legislation that's being passed is actually rather absurd, because the United States is not participating in the war in the hostilities as they're described. They've only been providing logistical support to and intelligence to the Saudis to minimize any civilian deaths and humanitarian sort of catastrophes. So the Saudi, their ability to prosecute the war is limited to the regional armies that we know in the region and their capabilities. However, that said, in recent weeks, they've been making great strides in moving towards the port of Hudaydah. And they've made a lot of gains around it. And it is at that particular point that sort of the supporters of the realignment with Iran sort of sprung into action. And their priority today is to halt that offensive at all costs. And so the Khashoggi affair and this legislation has prompted sort of threw people basically off balance a little bit and has given momentum to sort of an idea that, oh, everything needs to de-escalate and let's see if we can move back to peace talks and so on and so forth. And so there is a little bit of a slowdown in the operations, which is allowing the Houthi forces to bring in reinforcements and to consolidate their position a little bit more. But the Saudi coalition had been moving gradually to retake that port. It's an important point because it's the port on the Red Sea. So if this becomes open for traffic, then you're opening the possibility, like we're seeing in Lebanon now, where the airport can, where you see Iranian planes carrying weapons just basically landing at the airport. So it's a very tricky situation. Yeah.
Well, the important point there that I think you made is that we're watching people who were wrong on Iran in the Obama administration now pressing to save Iran's bacon, if I can use that expression, in Yemen. And it does – I want to come back to Lebanon because I think the experience of these kinds of cessation of hostilities that have actually translated into the consolidation of power by Lebanon's Iranian proxies, Hezbollah most especially, is such a really dramatic warning of what might yet happen in a place like Yemen as well. But just to turn to Lebanon, Tony Bedran, one of the things that I think it's indisputable is the extent to which the Lebanese Hezbollah have, with Iran's strong backing, really consolidated their power in that country, not just in the south, as you say, where these missiles are now pointed by the hundreds of thousands, we're told, at the entirety of Israel, but, you know, in terms of other parts of the country as well, including the Sunni and Christian areas. Talk a bit about what's happening there and what the implications would be if Iran is successful in sort of completing this Shiite crescent, as it's called, in the region.
Well, so in Lebanon, I mean, it's game over, basically. They already run the place. They control the place from top to bottom. There is no opposition to them. They have majority in parliament. They have total control over the negotiations over the formation of the new government, where they will have important portfolios that, like the Ministry, let's say, of Public Health, which they're going to control, which makes it a humanitarian ministry, which they think is going to make them exempt from any sanctions and which will open the door for lucrative money-making and money-laundering possibilities for them. So Lebanon is such now, like I said, where Iranian planes land directly in Beirut International Airport, carrying with them, you know, missile components that increase the accuracy of Hezbollah's arsenal. This puts the Israelis in a dilemma, because if the Israelis are going to target these facilities or these flights or their shipments, then according to the rules of engagement that have been set between them and Hezbollah, this is going to lead to a broader conflagration, because Hezbollah is going, unlike what has been happening in Syria, where Hezbollah has been absorbing Israeli strikes, in Lebanon, they will respond. But the real analogy is actually to what's going on in Syria, because the policy of what has been called de-escalating the conflict in Syria. Well, look at what has happened as a result. You de-escalate the conflict. You allowed the IRGC and the Assad regime forces to systematically move their finite resources around, besiege areas that were held by the opposition, and then ultimately take them over, including now most recently right on the border with Israel, where they've taken the last positions of the opposition near the Golan. And now you have that situation now on the Golan as well. So the base or the idea of establishing Iranian bases is now expanding not just in Lebanon, but also in Syria, which is why you see Israel over the last several years, as a matter of fact, but certainly over the last couple of years, targeting facilities of precision, what they call precision missiles or long-range missiles throughout Syria.
Tony Bedran, we are out of time. There is much more to talk with you about, and I hope we'll have a chance to do so in the near future. Keep it up, my friend. Come back to us again soon. Next up, we'll speak with Joseph Heumeier right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. We are pleased to have with us Joseph Heumeier, the executive director of a really important organization, the Center for a Secure Free Society, a man who has specialized for much of his career, including in the United States Marine Corps, on matters involving Latin America and our vital interests in a part of the world that we have for too long, I'm afraid, seriously neglected. He has been very active in particular in making book on what a group we've been talking about with Jonathan Speier and Tony Bedran, Hezbollah, is up to, not just in the Middle East and Lebanon and other places like that, but here in our own, well, I think of it not as our backyard, but front yard of Latin America. It's good to have you back, Joseph. Thank you so much for taking a few minutes to talk.
Thanks, Frank. It's always a pleasure to be on your show.
Well, let's get a sort of update from you, Joseph. The Hezbollah organization is not, of course, the only problem we've got in our hemisphere that has been planted here by nations hostile to us, in this case, Iran. But it's a particularly insidious one. Where is it operating, and what kinds of things is it up to that we should be very concerned about?
Now, Hezbollah is a very multifaceted organization, as you know, Frank, and they're involved in a lot of things, pretty much in every country in Latin America at some level. You know, in some countries, they're a lot more present, and countries, there's a very small presence. But I'd say pretty much just about every country they have, especially where there's a country where there's a strong or a large Arab community, particularly a Lebanese community or a Syrian community. Hezbollah, because of its large diaspora networks that runs out of Lebanon, they've been able to tap into a lot of those communities. So the number one thing that they're involved in Latin America is criminal activity. They're involved in all kinds of organized crime rackets, anything from money laundering to counterfeiting to drug trafficking. So particularly when it comes to Latin America, Hezbollah's equal a transnational criminal organization as they are a terrorist organization. I think that's something that our U.S. law enforcement is really understanding a lot more as time goes along. But that doesn't mean they're not doing terror operations or terror plots. They've been involved in several terror plots, including ones as recent as 2014 and others that are involved using elements in Latin America to try to find terror plots in the United States. So they're still doing that. But actually beyond even those two aspects, Hezbollah is also doing a lot of political work, and that's in conjunction with Iran, using their capabilities to subvert foreign governments, to sway the political dynamics in those governments, and to shift them more favorable to Iran, so that Iran could build its alliances in Latin America. So I think Hezbollah is doing a lot of things in Latin America, a lot of stuff that most people don't realize, but it's very active.
Now, when you say that the U.S. government is paying closer attention to this, I understand that the Treasury and State Departments have recently sanctioned Hezbollah in connection with essentially what it's doing as the right arm of Iranian terror and more generally insurgent operations. Is that in part aimed at what's happening in Latin America, Joseph?
Yeah. So, I mean, one of the things I wanted to, when I was telling about how the U.S. law enforcement, particularly paying attention to what Hezbollah is doing in Latin America, the Department of Justice, Attorney General Jeff Sessions, just very recently named the top five transnational criminal organizations in Latin America and said that that's what the Department of Justice is going to focus on. And among those top five TCOs, as they're called, three of them were Mexican drug cartels. One of them is a prominent gang from Central America, the MS-13. And the fifth one is Hezbollah. So he officially labeled Hezbollah as a top drug trafficking transnational criminal organization in the entire region, above other organizations in South America or others that are better known. So I think that was a very important policy pivot to understand that Hezbollah has a tremendous robust network in the region that is involved in criminal activity, absolutely, but it's also it's all the stuff that they do in the Middle East, they're able to do it as well. And I think that is extending itself into countries like Venezuela, where you're seeing, pretty much Venezuela looked at not just as a government, a criminalized state, a government that's involved in all this illicit criminal activity, potentially a terror sponsor state, which is something the Trump administration is now weighing to designate them and put them on that very exclusive list of state sponsors of terror.
Yeah. And do you think that's both warranted and actually likely to happen?
I do think it can happen. It's absolutely warranted in terms of does Venezuela sponsor or aid and abet terror organizations. And Frank, you know that they've been doing that for a very long time, originally with Colombian terror organizations such as the FARC and the ELN, but also Middle East terror organizations such as Hezbollah. Their immigration system has been designed to pretty much provide a cover platform for terrorists that want to transit through the Western Hemisphere. They've absolutely been helping. The big question, and I was involved in a discussion with the intelligence community on the merits of this designation, and the big discussion actually wasn't about is there enough evidence to put that label on Venezuela. The discussion was more about is this the right time? Does this help our efforts to solve the crisis in that country, or does it hinder? And I think that's where I'm a bit more nuanced in my position. I think that's a strong arrow in our quiver, so to speak. It's a strong mechanism that we could use to pressure, but we have to use it at the right time. And I'm not sure that now is the right time to do that, because I think in order to use that quiver and to use it effectively, we have to know what's going to happen next, how both
the regime of Venezuela is going to respond, and more importantly, how their terror-sponsored friends, such as North Korea and Iran, will respond in kind. So until we're ready to understand how this plays out in a strategic sense, I don't think we should use that designation quite yet.
Interesting. Well, it's certainly warranted, as you say, and the question is there ever going to be a good time? And I'm not sure there is, but this is certainly a place where some truth-telling, I have the feeling, could help us in dealing with this, both in the region and on the international stage. Let me ask you about, speaking of terrorism, increasing reports out of the Department of Homeland Security, including from the secretary of that department, Joseph Humeyer, that there are, in fact, people out of the Middle East and presumably involved with organizations like Hezbollah or perhaps other dangerous groups, the Islamic State, Hamas, who knows, coming into or in proximity to, at least, our country through these caravans and otherwise trying to penetrate our porous southern border. Your thoughts on whether that's true, and if so, how serious a problem it represents?
No, thanks, Frank. I'm glad you mentioned that. It's absolutely true that there's individuals from outside of Latin America that are mixed within the caravan. I spent a week in late October with Guatemalan intelligence looking at the caravans, both on the border with Honduras and then on the border with Mexico. And there is at least 232 individuals that have been detected to be involved, mixed within the caravan, that are from countries of South Asia, Africa, and very possibly the Middle East. The reason you can't confirm that they're from the Middle East is because we don't have the true identities of these individuals. They're all undocumented. We don't know exactly where they're from. And there has been historical precedents where some of these individuals have lied. For instance, not too long ago, a group of five, quote-unquote, Pakistanis came into Guatemala, but they turned out to be Palestinians and turned out to be involved in the potential terror plot. So it's very hard to find the true identities of these individuals. Homeland Security, ICE, CPB is down there, and they use biometric techniques to try to help and find some of these individuals. But this is a known route that's been established. It's called the SIA route. SIA stands for Special Interest Aliens. That's a classification that the Homeland Security gives to a collection of 35 countries that are terror-prone, have a high-density terrorist organization, and that is a route that the caravan is using. So that's 100% certain, and I was down in Guatemala to verify that information.
And yet you hear from government officials, particularly in the democratic lawmaking mode, that there's nothing to this. There's, you know, no reason to be concerned that there are such people approaching our border, let alone getting into our country. I gather you would not agree with those comments.
I think really the media has made a mistake on the caravan. I think the media has driven a narrative that this is just migration. These are people fleeing from crime and violence. And listen, there's people that are fleeing from crime and violence all year round in Latin America, particularly in Central America. But this group right now is moving like a missile. It is moving at a pace and at a rate that's far beyond any other migration group. And it's large. It's huge. So this, I think we have to separate this group from other irregular or illegal migrants that are coming all year round. This group is highly organized, it's highly efficient, and it's mixed with subversive elements such as some of these irregulars that come from Africa, Middle East, and Asia. The question is, who's organizing it and for what? And I think when you get to that question, you start to look at some of these anti-American actors in Latin America, such as Venezuela, Bolivia, Nicaragua, and their extra-regional buddies like Iran.
Joseph Humeyer, we have to leave it at that for the moment. I'd hope to talk to you a little bit about the G20 meeting, which is, of course, taking place in Argentina, but that will be for another day, maybe in the aftermath of it all. Thank you for the great work that you do and for joining us from time to time. I hope you will come back to us again soon and that the rest of you will come back to us again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.